letting me visit sort of Perimeter Institute and giving a talk. It's really a pleasure to be here. And I'll profit of this time to talk a bit about the work that I've been doing in cosmologies, in which there is an interaction between dark energy and other things in the universe. So in particular, I will have a look at the beginning. There are two possible couplings. So interaction with gravity, we'll see what that means. Or interaction just with cold dark matter. We'll see also what's the status of the of our work for this sector. And then I will focus a bit more on the coupling of dark energy with neutrinos, because that's the topic on which we are mostly working at present, you know, within the cosmology group in Gutenberg. Okay, so we all know that observations have given us a very surprising picture of the universe, in which, as we know, the universe is spatially flat. The expansion is at present recently started accelerating, and also most of its content is actually dark. So there is about 70% in particular of dark, so-called dark energy, which we still know yet, of course, what dark energy is. So what is dark energy? So we know that the first guess to understand what dark energy is receiving a cosmological constant. So it's just saying that it's a constant contribution.
Do you need a pointer, actually?
Well, if there is, that would be nice.
But there's a laser pointer in here. I'm sorry. Somebody should have half this thing.
Yes, you can see it.
Yep.
So again, cosmological constant, which at present is really in agreement with all observations, but from a theoretical point of view, it's still somehow unsatisfactory, because we can't understand why. We can't predict its small value. And also, it really marks our epoch as a very special time in the universe, because dark energy is only of the same order of magnitude as matter fields right now, while it has been always different in the past and will be always different in the future if we allow for just a constant contribution. So that's why the next step was to say, okay, maybe it's not constant, maybe dark energy is a dynamical quantity, like after all other quantities, all other densities in the universe. And in the simplest case, this is associated to a scalar field, namely quintessence, which draws down some potential. And within these models, there were actually some features, for example, the presence of attractive solutions, which were quite appealing for the fine-tuning problem, because in these kinds of models, within a wide range of initial conditions for the scalar field and for its first derivative, the scalar field always goes to the same trajectory, so you don't have to fine-tune the initial conditions. It's also true that actually, so at present, since the equation of state of the scalar field needs to be very close to -1, as observations have pointed out, in these models, what happens is that to get an equation of state very close to -1, you have to flatten the potential more and more, so that you mimic more and more the case of a cosmological constant. And the initial range of allowed initial conditions shrinks more and more. So at the end, the limit, you are back to the same problems of fine-tuning that you have for a cosmological constant. Okay, so this is why somehow the difficulties of quintessence models, and also the lack of a real clear explanation from a theoretical point of view of what dark energy is, has led people to approach this issue from a different point of view. So let's see if we can understand something by allowing dark energy to interact with other things in the universe. And so let's see how this changes, for example, the behavior of the species which are interacting with dark energy. Let's see if we can learn something more about dark energy by understanding these kinds of interaction. And in principle, there's no reason why indexes should just be on its own without being coupled to other things.
There is a reason. Yes, the technical naturalness, if you take it as a reason, right? Because any quantum loops of dark matter or anything would try to induce a mass for dark energy, right? And you need a really, really flat potential.
Yeah. But
so if it couples derivatively, fine. If it couples to the mass directly, we're back to the same problem, you know, of massless scalar field coupled substantially to mass. So the technical naturalness point of view, you would say, okay, I'm willing to tolerate dark energy that doesn't couple from matter. There is one person, and I believe it's your collaborator, that argues against this point very vehemently, right? So
what is his argument?
Well,
fixed point in near the Planck scale that somehow cures everything, right? But that's not true when you say that there is no argument why it should be, it should not be coupled.
I don't see why it shouldn't interact. But of course, there might be problems related to the interaction if the scalar field, for example, acquires a mass from the interaction. However, let's say, okay, we will see that. I mean, as you already mentioned, in the especially in the coupling to neutrinos, the cure is the dilation symmetry, but that's we'll see that.
One other comment: if you interpret dark energy as a vacuum energy, you wouldn't expect. I would expect the vacuum energy to couple to the dark matter particle.
It's not vacuum.
It's a matter of principle.
It's not.
If it was vacuum, it wouldn't. You're right.
No.
No.
So if it's not vacuum energy, what is it? Is it made of?
So in this couple models.
Oranges and apples. What's it made of?
From a theoretical point of view, there is still no explanation. I mean, otherwise we would. we wouldn't be here, right? But so we'll see what I mean by coupling, by interaction. But usually we are still in the framework in which there is quintessence. So there is a scalar field which rolls down a potential. So this is still the framework that we see.
Typically, in this kind of situation in modern physics, you start putting epicycles when things don't work. Keep adding every cycle. But I mean, please continue.
Okay, so I'll just again see a bit. So there are three main branches that have developed. I'm trying to understand what's this, how dark energy can interact with other things. So coupling to gravity, coupling to dark matter, or coupling to gravity. In particular, the interest is in the role that it has in the clustering in this machine model. Okay, so I'll start with the first one, which is, again, the possibility of dark energy coupled to gravity. What I mean by that is just it comes from the temptation to explain the dark energy contribution via an extension of general relativity, so usually within scalar tensor theories of gravity. So in your scalar tensor theory, instead of just having the usual gravitational coupling term, which is just the Ricci scalar, you have a function which couples a scalar field, which in principle, I mean, it's nothing to do with dark energy. It was started, I mean, long before the dark energy issue, which is so a function of some scalar field and the Ricci scalar. Then usually one just chooses a product for simplicity of two functions, which is just the product of a function of only phi times the Ricci scalar. And then the scalar field has it's some kinetic energy, it's potential, and if you try to interpret the scalar field as your dark energy scalar field, then these are the models to which usually people prefer is extended incandescence.
Can I just ask your point about the potential being upset by coupling the matter? I mean, this holds true for these scalar tensor theories as well.
So again, is there a problem with couples?
I mean, it's the same thing. I mean, usually these, you know, you can write these as R squared theories. I mean, you can write these as F of R theories, or you can go into a different frame, right?
I think the problem, I believe the problem remains.
Your problem remains here.
So that's the problem.
It's away from them, you know. You can rescale. Let's rescale everything so it stays 5 years in front of the masters.
Mm-hmm.
So then you have just the regular sort of particle physics problem. Why the loops of matter would not induce, you know, fine self interaction.
Yeah, so for that problem, really, I think probably I can mention it a bit better in the neutrino case, but in general, that's why one uses an exponential potential, and that's why one tries to talk about this dilatation symmetry, which guarantees that the quantum effects, I mean, don't spoil the flatness of the projection. And the
symmetry is not exact symmetry.
Yeah,
it's exactly.
As it's exactly the anomaly. Yeah, the potential introduces an anomaly. And as you approach the flat solution for the flat direction for the potential, so as you approach restoration of exact symmetry, you guarantee that the mass of the scalar field keeps small and that you're back to. Yeah, I mean, you don't have problems with quantum.
What is the dilatation symmetry?
That's just say.
Just chucks, I think, in the bottom in the cup there. Just the,
in the cup.
The cup.
So that's just scalar field forming into 5 plus. Some theta, which has arbitrary values. So if there is a potential, then there is an anomaly in this dilatation. This type dilatation is not exactly fulfilled.
Also, all mass terms
so
while they.
This was.
All mass terms while they go in the locations.
Yeah, and the mass term. And the mass term. Yeah. So the point is that, of course, in the, when you reach in dilatation, so there is a. Yeah, as you were mentioning, there is a paper from Fritz of 2008 approaching exactly this all these issues, and saying exactly that when you do a really a naive calculation of quantum fluctuations in these theories, you get, for example, terms which are proportional to the square of the mass. Of the species that couples to dark energy, and that can spoil both the mass and the flatness of the potential. But this doesn't respect the symmetry of the theory, which is approached when you go to the attractor solution. I mean, I will, especially in the case of the neutrinos for a constant coupling, you approach in the future the case of a flat direction for the potential. So there is a restoration, you approach restoration of the dilatation symmetry, and as you do that, you guarantee that the mass of the scalar field keeps small. At least that's what.
With neutrinos, you can get away by having a very small power properties. And as in the original models by Wanner and Nelson, right? So they're conscious about the problem of technical naturalness. And in their case, it's just any loop is postular. A lot of color couplings.
So in that case, it's different actually from the model that I would consider, because in that case they have an effect of the coupling also in the past, which is not present here, as we see ever so we show in the model we are considering, and also they have a massive scalar field.
Mm-hmm.
so which is not the case, you know. So in our case, the exponential and the approaching the restoration of the Dartesian symmetry guarantees that the scalar field is still of the order of the upper scale.
But their paper is understandable to regular folks like me without resorting to studying this. Right?
It's a very nice paper, and I completely agree. But I think we'll get to the third case.
One other thing.
So,
I think we should let her go on because.
So this is just this is just the start thing. As you know, this is equivalent to just a wide way to include that for in coupling in interaction theory, because this is so having a scalar tensor theory is equivalent to just having GR in which the dark energy, so the scalar field, couples universally from the same coupling to all matter fields. And by coupling, I mean that the mass of matter fields are now not a constant anymore, but they are a function of the scalar field. So, with this kind of expression. So, I just wanted to mention something, some effects both at the background and linear perturbation level already in these theories, because these are somehow typical effects that you always have when you have interaction between dark energy and other things. So at the background level, you see already from the plot of the energy densities, so this is matter, this is radiation with respect to redshift. If you have a just quintessence scalar field, usually it's very flat if you want an equation of state very close to minus one today. And then there are two cases of scalar tensor theories for two kinds of coupling. This is a quadratic coupling, and this is an exponential coupling, which of course gives even a higher contribution. So there is a very dark energy component in the past. And this is due basically to the presence of the gravitational interaction, so of a new effective potential which appears in the Klein-Gorton equation, which actually dominates completely over the true potential V. So what was interesting for these models was, for example, to do a full analysis of attractor solutions only due to the presence of the coupling, of the gravitational coupling, and not due to the specific choice of V, of the true potential. So that's nice, somehow you extend the properties of attractor solutions that you have in quintessence models to the case in which you have a coupling with gravity. So now the attractor is due to the gravitation, to a gravitational effect. Okay, you can calculate linear perturbations for these theories, and you see that you can rewrite the gravitational potential, redefining some effective gravitational potential, and all the equations like that look the same, apart that effectively you have dynamical gravitational constants. Somehow this series behaves as series in which the gravitational constant is not constant anymore, but it's some function of the scalar field. And if you modify its own linear codes, the Boltzmann codes, we modify D fast. It's an implementation of CUD fast to take into account these modified gravity theories. You can, for example, see typical effects which appear in the CMB power spectrum. So there are, for example, two main effects which are always present when you deal with interaction, dark energy interacting with other things. So one is the projection effect, which means that peaks are just shifted because the expansion changes, and so you're shifted to high, to lower, or smaller scales, smaller or larger scales, according to if the expansion, the output parameter is bigger or smaller in the past. And then you have at large scales a larger integrated subswap effect, which is related directly to how the gravitational constant changes, how much the gravitational potential changes. So typically the dynamics of the gravitational potential is higher in these kinds of models when you have an interaction, so you have a stronger integrated subswap effect. However, within bounds that you have for these theories, especially from solar system scales, from the Cassini emission, for example, at least at solar system scales, you're never going to see actually these kinds of effects. I mean, this is just exaggerated in order to to see what effects are.
So the gravitational constant is changing effectively.
Yeah.
Is it changing? Are the sort of surfaces of constant g the homogeneous?
It's a function of the scalar field, so it's a function of time.
It's a function of time, but is it homogeneous roughly? Is g changing sort of? Okay.
Yeah, and this is important, of course, because when we want to, we show now see nonlinear effects. So what we did, for example, was taking this into account in n-body simulations to see how structure formation changes.
And so how much has G changed from now until?
It depends, of course, on your coupling function,
It's 10 to the negative 1 or 10 to the negative 10? Well, how much?
It's not much, like probably a few percent.
I was curious about the stability of the solar system or something like that.
But so this is why at the linear level, probably it's possible to see an effect on the inbounds. But with, at the non-linear level, we are still analyzing at present the data. We have modified it together with people in particular with Tassel in Munich. We modified gadgets in order to include an effective gravitational interaction between particles. And now at present we are analyzing the data to see what are the effects at nonlinear level.
So we can see limits, delta G to be less than 10 minus 3 or something.
The
omega term
density.
But does it limit exactly?
It limits the scalar component of the gravitational force through the relativistic.
Solar systems.
It's been tested.
Yeah. But the plot that I show you, for example, for the background, that's already taking omega Jordan density times to the fifth.
And the fifth.
Yeah. So it's completely in agreement with the solar system bounds. Of course, those are only valid at solar system scales. I mean, there are complementary bounds on these theories at cosmological scales, which are actually less stricter than that. For example, there's an analysis from Aqualiva et al. Analyzing the effects, the constraints from CMB in this series, so cosmological scales, they did it just for quadratic coupling, and instead of having 10 to the fourth, they have 120 as the maximum value for Jordan density. So it's less strict. I mean, there's still some space to play.
So in your simulations, is the field a scalar field? Is it? Does it have nonlinear evolution in response scales or
the dark energy?
Yeah, the scalar field phi. But
there's no dark energy. You just have your dark matter and bionic.
You have a scalar field, right? Phi. You have a scalar.
So effectively, you have it when you have, for example, when you have the expansion. So the expansion, of course, uses the code in which there is also the scalar. The growth factor, for example, so the evolution of the linear density perturbations that you need for the initial conditions for the n-body, that also you get from linear codes, and that also takes into account, of course, perturbations in the non-linear theory, which include the dark energy scalar field. But effectively, in the n-body code, you just have particles interacting with the Newtonian gravity. Okay. It's just that the effective G that you have is dynamical one.
Changes with time.
Yeah.
But it's exactly. Constant on slices.
Yes. And at present, I mean, this is already, it's already non-trivial to modify n-body with the time.
So you're just changing the time something in the code. If G is the only thing that's changing the code, all you're doing is changing the time stepping.
So this is not exactly this is not only there is also again the expansion which is changing the initial conditions because the growth factor is different.
Okay, so I've never been clear on this. Is phi tracking, phi is tracking some symbol value of time, right? It's not, you don't have a different value of phi inside the perturbations.
anyway,
so it's not clear
to
me you actually need, until you put the gas in, it's not clear to me you need to give the centration at all. It's all you're doing is changing your definition.
No, but
of time
there's, again, so I pointed out this one because this is the main characteristic of these theories. Of course, you also have to change the background expansion and the linear growth for to rescale initial conditions.
Right, but the point is that you won't have to modify any of the m-body code, just put in a different linear growth, but you also change the time step.
So, yeah, I mean, that's...
So it's like, it's equivalent to a slightly different dark energy, or
yeah,
it has a different expansion history.
Yeah, it's not a linear function of transpose, it's a function of the scalar field,
right,
which also is whose evolution with time is also obtained by solving the equation.
I don't think what you're saying is obvious there. I don't think G is the changing G as a function of time is equivalent to redefining
yeah.
time.
I think it is.
Why do you say that?
It's the only scale in the simulation. There is no other scale. You pick a value for G and that's it. There is no other time. Until you put in gas or something.
Okay, so imagine like a binary, right?
Mm-hmm.
And let's say you're changing G.
Mm-hmm.
The size of the binary changes, right? The diameter of the orbit.
Mm-hmm.
The size of the orbit changes. So there is a non-trivial effect. Right.
So, I would point it out that kind of modification just to make also the difference with the case in which we couple only two quotas max. That's maybe it would be clearer what the modifications are than the other case. So, what one usually calls coupled quintessence is just quintessence coupled only to quotas max. But in the other case, that same G also applies to all species, so it also applies to baryons and kotak, I mean, to all the particles that you have in your so if you have only a coupling with kotak matter, then of course your kotak matter, the mass of the kotak matter particle is now a function of the scalar field. So we're still within a quintessence model, there's still a scalar field rolling down a potential, and you see at the background level, again, there is same qualitative effects. So you have an early dark energy component at early times. You can, again, calculate linear perturbations for these theories. And you can put, for example, constraints already here in this case. There are quite tight constraints from the CMB. On the coupling of dark energy only to hold dark matter. There's an analysis from Rachel Bean a few months ago. This is only, however, in the case in which the coupling is constant. So there might be more space to play somehow if the coupling has another expression, which somehow we have tried to generalize linear codes, like, for example, CMB is to do a Monte Carlo, which takes into account more general possible interaction of dark energy with cold dark matter. Anyway, usually the value of the coupling is 0.1, 0.2, or not bigger than that. So in this case, the n-body codes have to be modified in a much more complicated way. So why? Well, first, because you only have an effective gravitational interaction between dark matter particles. While between dark matter and baryons, or between baryons and baryons, you always have the usual G gravitational constant. So this is the first point. Second point
well,
is that...
Approximately, right? So, in fact, also between dark matter and baryons, you have a slightly different G.
No. You can see it from the equation. So the second point is that the mass of the quotas mass of particles is changing, of course. So you also have quotas mass of particles whose mass decreases in time, you know, in n-body code. And also there is another effect, which also plays a big role, which is an extra kinematic and friction term due to the coupling, and the extra somehow respect to the usual one just due to the expansion of the other parameter. So there are three main effects which have to be taken into account besides the log factor, besides the background expansion. So this has been done in particular from a student, Marco Valdi, student of Volker Springer in Munich. And we have finished. We have run simulations and got several results from these simulations. Of course, you expect that the way in which dark matter interacts and form structures changes if you couple it to a component which opposes to gravity. So there are several effects. Here I will just show you in particular, for example, the density profile of the halos and see how this changed. But there are also several others regarding, for example, concentration, regarding, for example, the bias that you have due to the coupling. Because linear perturbations for both dark matter and variance, since they go differently because they feel a gravitational constant. So you have a scale-dependent bias between variance and cold dark matter, which is also another typical feature of these interactions.
Variance follow just the gravitational potential of CDS.
The usual gravitational constant. While the cold dark matter follows this effective dynamical gravitational interaction.
Can I understand that intuitively why we have less steep less profiles? Is there some
So I will show you more. Now, so this is an interesting point, and so what we get, I will show first the result, and then I can say some comments about what we get. So what we have is that you see this is so higher density profile and the inner slope, as you see, it's less and less steep as you increase the coupling. The black one is lambda CDM, and as you increase the coupling, you have a less steep profile. Now, this is in contrast with what has been obtained from the only small simulations that have been done in the past for these models from Andrea Macho et al. In this case, this is lambda CDM. And as you increase the coupling, you have a bigger, more and more steep inner profile. So of course, we wondered a lot about this difference. We did several. The two simulations are somehow different in many respects for resolution, for the way that you carried out. We have done several different tests on these simulations. At the present, we are actually very confident on our simulations. We have some ideas of why there is this difference. We think that it's due in particular. So there are two main effects. Because as you were saying, for example, if you have a bigger gravitational constant, as it is usually in these cases, then you would expect a steeper inner profile.
The gravitational constant thing is constant,
it's always bigger in this case because it doesn't depend on the sign of the coupling, it only depends on the square of the coupling, so usually it's always bigger. But the point is that there is also this extra friction term, which is in the direction of the velocity, which is centripetal, which also plays a very important role. And somehow we've checked that these two effects somehow balance. And so you have, a much smaller effect than this case. And also you actually have a less steep inner profile. So we have checked that also with, for example, the effect on halo concentrations. The concentrations decreases. So what happens? What we think is happening is that basically the halo somehow expands, the concentration decreases, and the inner slope is less steep. So this is what exactly, this is at least what we...
What are the betas, the beta, what is the value?
So we did it for the same models that have been studied in Macho et al. So there are So this RP stands for rat and people, so there's inverse power law potential in the model, and then the different values of either alpha, so the parameter in the inverse power law, and beta. So RP5, for example, has a stronger value as 0.2 as a value of beta. And RP1 and RP2 differ for the inverse power law potential. They have the same value of the coupling, which is 0.1.
So you can listen to something, sorry.
Yeah.
Your interaction doesn't change with it. So it's not a power law power R, no? Even with that beta square in the
which
normalizes between dark matter particle, it just renormalizes the Newton constant, but it doesn't change
That's one of the effects in this case.
Yeah. So that effect only would you expect? So this part
only from that
change
effect.
Effect. It shouldn't change anything. If I understand.
Well, if it's bigger, you expect that they form a rarity or that they have a mean force of time scale change. But the point is that it's not only that. So the mass.
Yeah. No,
the fact that the mass, for example, changes is not one of the dominant effects, but the friction is really dominant, as much as the gravitational constant.
I think.
Yeah.
I have to make a comment. Absolutely. it's a very serious situation that we have, because there are so many models. For example, I work with modified gravity without dark matter. And the theory we've claimed to fit the data. Everybody's claiming to fit the data effectively. So it's a serious situation. We need to be able to discriminate to find out who's right. Because the basic problem is that no one's ever detected dark matter. But we haven't detected dark energy. So we're working in the dark.
I know, and I completely agree, of course.
This is getting to the point where you have enough parameters.
No,
you're all disagreeing with what's going on.
So here,
how do you resolve this issue?
Yeah. So of course, I mean, the main point of these kinds of models was exactly to find some observable feature which characterizes this model, and exactly because you want to discriminate within models and to get bounds from data. So this is why somehow I think at the linear level for these models, there is no way you can actually discriminate between models. But at the nonlinear level, I mean, these are analyses that have never been done. There was only a very small n-bot simulations for testing in the interaction of dark energy with cold dark matter. And there are effects, and for example, scale-dependent bias, I mean, can give you scales which are testable. Now we're working, for example, on testing that with BAO data, for example. So there are lots of things that you can actually do with data, but you need to have predictions for the models, of course. And that's why for these models we did n-bot simulations, which was somehow not trivial at all. But it's true that we need to learn something more about that energy. I completely agree. And this is why I put at the end the case of this coupling between dark energy and neutrinos. So this because these ones are somehow more appealing also from a theoretical point of view, and how they address more the problems of coincidence and fine tuning that you also have in a cosmological constant scenario. Unfortunately, we will see that for this case, the constraints by experiments are even more difficult to find. But yeah, we see now. So, but I completely agree that it's important to test models with observations, and that's why we have investigated all these theories at the nonlinear level, because I think that's the only part that can actually give you predictions to directly be tested with observations. Okay, so the third case is just the coupling of dark energy with neutrinos. We know that there have been several models testing this issue, so-called Maslow-Rank neutrino models. And in particular, what I've been working on is the case in which of this glowing neutrino model from this paper of Amendola and Christopher Mulcobaldi last year. So let's go back. On this case, I want also to focus a bit on what really happens in the model. So let's first consider just a scalar field rolling down an exponential potential without, for the moment, with no interaction. So what we have is that we know that the exponential potential is characterized by attractive solutions. So we know that the dark energy falls into the attractive solution and tracks the background. So it tracks the dominant component, the radiation, the radiation-dominated era, matter, the matter-dominated era. And we also, as we see here, this is dark energy in green tracking for dark matter in black during matter-dominated era. So of course this doesn't work, right? Because if you want acceleration to happen at recent times, we need the dark energy to leave the attractor, otherwise we never dominate over the background. And the point is that we would like to associate the dark energy leaving this attractor era to a cosmological event rather than to some specific choice of the potential. Okay, so the cosmological event that actually in these models triggers the end of the attractor era is neutrinos becoming non-relativistic. So what happens is the following. So we have, and of course the extra ingredient is the interaction between dark energy and neutrinos. And you write the interaction in the conservation equations as in the other cases. So there is an opposite source term in such a way that only the total energy density is actually conserved. The mass of the neutrinos is now varying in your Lagrangians. It's just the mass of the neutrinos, which is varying, is a function of the scalar field. So what happens is the following. For a long time in the past, neutrinos are relativistic. So they don't play, so their equation of state is 1/3, and the coupling doesn't play any role. This is just zero, and you're just back to the case of a quintessence scalar field that rolls down an exponential potential. So your dark energy goes into the attractor, it falls, or it follows the background. And what happens is that then the neutrino mass grows until neutrinos become non-relativistic. And when this happens, the coupling becomes active again. And it gives an extra, somehow, effective potential, an extra contribution in which the scalar field, in the Klein-Gordon equation for the scalar field, that almost stops the dark energy. So the dark energy is kicked out of the attractor solution, the exponential potential, and it's almost stopped until it leads to acceleration. We see it here. So first, dark energy is just tracking the background. Then neutrinos become non-relativistic. The coupling becomes active. We see it in these oscillations of the coupled fluid. So the dark energy is kicked out of the attractor. It stops tracking the background. It's almost stopped because of this kind of wall that it faces because of this extra contribution in the Klein-Gordon equation given by the interaction. And at some point, of course, it will dominate over dark matter. And one nice feature of this model, which was somehow one of the original motivations also for these models, is to relate the properties of dark energy, so the amount of dark energy today and the equational state today, to the mass of the neutrinos, to the properties of the neutrinos. So they are related. The parameter here, okay, alpha is the parameter in the exponential potential, which is somehow bound by the amount of early dark energy that you have. So if it's order 10 or so, it's perfectly compatible with observation. And then there's beta, there's the cup, the parameter of the strength of the coupling. So in principle, if you measure dark energy today, and if you measure the mass of the neutrinos today, you would know how much beta should be, how big the coupling should be. You should just go back in time and know exactly when this transition between the attractor phase and the almost starting phase took place. It's somehow like similar to the equivalence, right? You measure dark matter today, you measure radiation today, you go back, and you know when the equivalence took place.
How do you measure the neutrino mass along with time?
Yeah, you don't. The point is that of course, you so the point is
you do.
Well, but you do, don't you? So then I think I mean, we don't know exactly what the mass of the neutrinos is, right?
So in the standard model, it's literally model, it's a fixed model.
Well, there's a scalar coupling to the
evolution. In this case,
so mass is part of a scalar. Yes.
Yeah. In this case, it's a function. So the point is exactly, this is the main ingredient of the model. The mass of the neutrinos in this model is growing. It's a function of the scalar field. This is why they're called growing neutrino indefinite.
You have a commitment to what kind of neutrino model you have, whether you have a normal hierarchy, invert hierarchy, or that kind of stuff?
So there is at present, for the models that have been somehow studied, there is a lot different played by different neutrinos somehow. It's just, it doesn't depend on that, at least in this simple realization somehow of the model.
But I mean, if you had an inverted hierarchy, you could have neutrino masses which would be much relatively large, and
that's something
whereas,
interesting.
If you have the normal hierarchy, it's no more than like 50 millivolts, and so those corrections look like they'd be very small.
So that's of course interesting, but that hasn't been investigated somehow. So for the moment,
you're sort of assuming that it's more like the normal hierarchy. These masses are most likely to be very small and not perturbed.
And almost, yeah.
So those are small perturbations in your.
Small perturbation. What do you mean by small perturbation?
Well, go back to the other picture that you have the W zero equal minus one plus something over 12 electron volts.
Yeah, yeah. So it would be something.
That something there is small.
Yeah. Very close. Yeah. Which is actually what we want, right? The equational state of dark energy should be very close to minus.
I lost track of where the 12 and the 16 electron volts come from. That's just from the dip that works.
That's assuming the it's already written the half value of the Hubble parameter. Substituted inside.
Number
but actually, for the neutrino,
the scenario you showed us the previous pictures.
But for the this is what it's again for a constant beta. There's an interesting model that has been described also in a paper from Christoph Wetterich here in 2007, last year, just after the one with Luca Mendola about with the constant coupling. And in that case, he actually gets. Also from a theoretical point of view, a more natural description of how the neutrino mass can change. So he associates that with the fact that the neutrino mass can get a contribution from this CSO2 cascade mechanism, in which basically you have an extra contribution to the mass of the neutrinos, so which is inverse proportional to a very heavy mass. And if this heavy mass changes with time, then you can actually also, from a theoretical point of view, motivate more why your neutrino mass can actually change. So this is interesting. And you get, in that case, you have a varying a coupling that also depends on phi, so it's not, this beta is not a constant. And your mass is something which is, which goes like, 1 divided by 5 minus some value of transition. So phi, your dark energy approaches more and more this transition value, and as it approaches this value, the coupling becomes stronger and stronger. So the mass of in that case, that's
due to the neutrino mass would go back up?
So, of course, this depends then on the model. In the case, for example, of a constant coupling, at some point the energy density of neutrinos will dominate also in dark matter. Okay, so we calculated linear perturbations also for these models, and we implemented linear Boltzmann codes. So we did it both for SimpleEasy and CAM to have to plot, for example, either at fixed scale with, as a function of redshift, the density perturbations. And or, for example, as a function of the scale. So already from a linear analysis that can has been done again, implemented in implementing a CAMB and CMDEZ, we can already get some information about the effects of this interaction at the nonlinear level. So some hints for what might be really testable by observations. So this is what we see here in this plot. This is the redshift of nonlinearity. So this is just the redshift at which each density perturbations in your linear codes, which is a value of order 1, as a function of the scale, and for different species. So for cold dark matter in black, for dark energy in blue, for neutrinos in red, and then compared to the cold dark matter that you have in a lambda CPM model, with the same value of omega dark energy today. So there are two main things that I want to point out from this plot. So first one is that at large scales, so scales at which, as you see, cold dark matter in the lambda CDM would still be linear, the first species that actually becomes non-linear are neutrinos. So neutrinos feel this extra interaction mediated by dark energy. And they might be left to clump and form stable, huge lumps or nuggets, as you wish, whose solutions, the stable solutions of describing these nuggets were actually also analytically found in this Okay, so you have somehow a clear prediction of this model, which is the presence of huge structures, neutrino structures, at large scales. And I want to remark here that neutrinos at this point, at this level, just behave as cold dark matter. So you would really detect them, they are non-relativistic, so you would really detect them in the same way that you do for cold dark matter structures via their gravitational potential. So it's just a different scale. So this would be somehow the detection of a population of such structures at large scales would be an indication for an interaction which would be difficult to justify in a lambda CDM.
You're saying that the neutrinos could be the dark matter?
No. Dark matter is still there. No. Dark matter is still a
course. But if you can make neutrino mass vary like this, then why not make it the dark matter? You can do whatever you want with it.
No. But the neutrinos, first of all, they won't be so many. And you still have to justify dark matter contribution. First, they only cluster at large scales. If you see at small scales, what happens is that still the cold dark matter, as you wish, is the first species that becomes nonlinear, as you wish. I mean, you have, of course, all the structures formed by cold dark matter, while neutrinos just reach their free streaming length, so under which they can't actually cluster anymore. So the main point is that at large scales, neutrinos can form these huge stable lumps. And at small scales, you also see there is another effect, indirect effect of the coupling of the interaction of dark energy with neutrinos, which is the suppression of cold dark matter structures. As you see, they form later with respect to the lambda CDM one. This is due to two reasons, basically. One is that in the past, there's no interaction and you have an anti-dark energy component which slows down the structure formation. And also, for the same value of omega 5 today, of course, 1 minus omega 5 in the glowing neutrino model is not only due to all dark matter, but there's also a component of neutrinos, of non-relativistic neutrinos of matter. So, of course, here, if you just plot cold dark matter for the same value of one of omega 5, then you have again a reduction.
So, for this coupling, this is then ruled out.
What? No, why?
Well, I mean, the curves, as they're drawn here, are ruled out, and that we're sitting in a scale factor.
Why? So I,
sorry,
this
is
a
scale factor on the side or redshift?
This is a redshift here.
Or
I respect to scale. So at large scales, the first species
so saying,
around one is neutrinos.
You have gigaparsec scale clustering with neutrinos at redshift one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's going to be ruled out by the observation.
Not
by current VAO.
Why do you say it's not good? I mean, you should actually compare the power spectrum.
Of course, that's
yeah.
The point.
Yeah.
So at present, so this is of course.
If this is the nonlinear scale, that's all ruled out. Right? You can't have nonlinear structures on those scales at redshift 1. That's totally inconsistent with any measure of clustering between here and redshift 1.
So the point is...
Maybe I'm confused about what the red curve is.
So it's
just there isn't much matter in that cluster, is that right? So it's not just not creating big gravitational.
So of course, except
it's
so
a very dilute cluster.
Except they're not. I mean, so actually, I should be more somehow precise on this.
The red curve looks like it's very important, but in fact, it's extremely dilute that cluster. That
so the main point is the following. So this is somehow an analysis coming from linear. So it's valid until the first species, so neutrinos at large scales, all dark matter at small scales, become nonlinear. Then what happens in the linear code is that as soon as one species becomes nonlinear, you start feeding your gravitational potential with the nonlinear quantities, and you get, for example, a huge gravitational potential, which is not realistic because it doesn't correspond to the fact that neutrinos will actually form stable lumps, which have a bounded value of the gravitational potential. And also, if neutrinos, I mean, the hope is really that since neutrinos are not so many, and if they distribute into many huge of these lumps, your gravitational potential characterizing these neutrino lumps won't ever get bigger than a few percent. As I mean, it's in even cold dark matter structures, I mean, don't have even the biggest one. I mean, they don't have such huge gravitational potential. So of course, the main point now is what we are investigating now. So it's the point is that going to the nonlinear level to have an understanding of what happens to the gravitational potential. And of course, to find bounds, for example, from data, from CMB and so on, because as I said, if you just take the output of the linear code, you will get a gravitational potential that blows. And that gives you, for example, a huge infinite tax force effect. But this is a problem of the linear code. It's not, it doesn't correspond to the model, right? So what we are doing is solving nonlinear equations given an initial density profile for neutrinos under the effect of perturbations of the scalar field. Seeing how this density perturbation grows to find a gravitational potential, a realistic gravitational potential obtained by nonlinear equations, full nonlinear equations, which give you a realistic estimate of what the gravitational potential is corresponding to this population of neutrino structures. So once we've done that, which is in progress, because, yeah.
If you go back one slide again, does phi also become,
yes.
Phi is So now I'm confused. I remember like the argument was that if phi also starts to cluster, then you lose the whole idea of having the dark energy because the pressure
yeah.
starts to drop.
Yeah, so there are two points here. So first, again, you shouldn't trust lines after the first species has become nonlinear. So here you should only see at each scale the lines, the upper line. So this one, and this one. Then, of course, the dark energy here and even the whole dark matter are drugged by the gravitational potential to go nonlinear. But I mean, this effect is completely unrealistic because, again, if you just plot the gravitational potential from the linear code at small redshifts, you get a huge gravitational potential, which is it blows because it's fed by nonlinear quantities. So again, this is something, an estimate of the effect of dark energy can only be obtained once we have a full understanding of the nonlinear gravitational potential. At that point, we can feed the linear code, so we modify the Boltzmann code, with the realistic gravitational potential, and get an estimate and constrain, of course, the model with CMB data, for example, and so on. And also another point is that, again, as I was saying at the beginning, the mass of the scalar field due to this exponential potential is light, is kept to be light. So it's still order of the others. Okay, so just to for curiosity somehow, one could just since this of course takes some time, this is a full nonlinear analysis to get this gravitational potential, it's in progress, it's something we are working on in particular with the diploma here student Nico Pinterguest in Heidelberg. And so in the meantime, just for curiosity, what we did, what we can do, for example, is to just put a bound in our linear perturbation code, a bound on the gravitational potential, to see if it actually goes in the right direction, if you can actually get something which is similar to CMB. So and at least first results are somehow encouraging, in the sense of course, at this level, it's just somehow playing with parameters, because you are just putting by hand a bound on the gravitational potential. But at least you can get something which is very similar to CMB data. Now, of course, a full Monte Carlo analysis is necessary to actually see constraints from all data. But again, this can only be done once we have an understanding of the nonlinear gravitational potential, which corresponds to this huge neutrino structures. And at some point, you could also imagine to have, for example, at large scales, prediction for some oscillations due to the background oscillations of the coupled species between dark energy and neutrinos. So at the moment, the only bounds that are from background quantities, they are done from Rubin et al. In the Berkeley collaboration for using the union population for supernova. So they have bounds, this is the early dark energy and neutrino mass. And this is the same but with a prior on sigma 8. So we can have bounds. Okay, so we have, just to conclude, we have seen these three possible branches of interacting dark energy which have developed in theory. And again, as a summary, for these three branches, we finished the preview of the linear part, but most interesting effects actually come from the nonlinear part. We are at present, I'm also working on data analysis for the gravitational coupling. The nonlinear part for the cold dark matter is almost finished. It's probably we'll publish that next week, hopefully, or 2 weeks. And the thing that actually requires more time is the nonlinear part for the coupling to neutrinos. Because then again, we have to really solve the nonlinear equations. Okay. Okay, so conclusions for just to mention for the neutrinos, interaction of dark energy and neutrinos. So again, when neutrinos become non-relativistic, this is the main effect that triggers the end of the attractor era and almost stop the stellar field and leave the stellar field to dominate and give acceleration. In these models, neutrinos can first class at redshift around 1, so the cluster scales, large scales, and form these huge neutrino lumps. So that the detection of such a population of large scale structures would be an indication of such an interaction between neutrinos mediated by dark energy stellar field. So for future prospects, of course, now, I mean, since I've been working on linear perturbations, non-linear analysis, and this dark energy modeling, as it was actually pointed out, my wish is exactly to apply, to link the theory to observations. And this is why I joined the theory Dune group, so this ESA mission for dark energy for the cosmic vision program, for the post-Planck. Okay, now it's actually joined with space in the UK project. Okay, so that's it. Thanks.
Questions?
So I guess I should stop saying things are totally ruled out, but another thing I think is totally ruled out is reducing the amplitude of the dark matter fluctuations on small scales such that things that on your plot were supposed to collapse at redshift 3 are instead collapsing at redshift 1, right? Because that's reducing their density by a factor of 10. And there again, I presume if you actually put that in an in-body simulation, you find you can constrain that. You can't reduce the density of structures relative to lambda CM, even on microparsec scales or smaller, by a factor of 10 and not see that. So I don't know whether you actually see that in cosmic shear first or whether you see it in dwarf galaxy densities first or something. But that one. My guess is just that there is some quite strong constraint on all this stuff below.
Of course there are constraints which need to be investigated once we have again the nonlinear gravitational potential. And for this, again, for the effect of early dark energy, we already know what other constraints because, again, if the parameter in the exponential is roughly order 10, then you're fine with early dark energy at every time.
What I'm saying is,
And also, this is just because I'm plotting only CTA with the same value of omega 5 today. So this is why I get...
I mean, that is
different, but there are also non-relativistic neutrinos in the growing neutrino model.
So you mean that there's one thing that the degeneracy is, so it's not absolutely fixed.
So
there are
so
degeneracies, and this is, of course,
so
we need the Monte Carlo analysis to do that.
Presumably, you can't really do much with the spectral index because you're close enough to one. I don't know, maybe you can do spectral index. All I mean is, I don't think you can have the green curve and the black curve be that far apart at the present day. So I think that you got to fix that by changing something else.
Since there are degeneracies, I mean, the main point is to work on the Monte Carlo analysis. So for the moment, what we could do, just because of these difficulties of the nonlinear features, was just again to put a bound and find something that at least it's possible to have something which is similar to a CMB spectrum.
It just seems visually like the small scale effect is huge compared to the large scale effect, which, you know, sure you compare to the CMB and it's essentially zero.
This will probably put bounds on the value of beta, but also, I mean, just to mention, I mean, the beta that we have here. So you remember that I told you that in the case of the coupling with polar flux, beta is constrained to be 0.1, so right. Here, beta is 50.
Okay.
So of course, this would put beta, bounds on beta.
I have two main questions. I mean, we could not hear your structure cosmically,
Yeah, it's just a standard.
Another question is,
around the redshift, we call this bias, the economics is less than 1.5 dB or larger than 1.5 dB.
So at redshift 1, I don't know, but for this plot in particular, the value of the neutrino mass today is 2 electron volt.
Oh.
And of course, if you have a lower mass, if you have a smaller mass, it's even better because the effect will happen later, and you won't have time to form your gravitational potential won't have time to grow so much. So actually, you can compensate what matters is the product of the coupling and the mass of the neutrino. So if you have a smaller neutrino mass, you can compensate with a bigger. Again, it depends on the mass of the neutrino for the relation that I gave you before. If you knew the mass of the neutrinos today, then you could know how big the coupling should be.
But when the mass of the neutrino is small, then it's difficult for neutrino to
if form it's too the small, mass. Then it's going to it just might be then difficult to form stable lumps.
Yeah.
That would be, some range. It really depends on the neutrino mass. I mean, somehow the point is to relate dark energy to a problem that, related to the neutrino mass that you still have. I mean, somehow neutrino masses are there anyway.
Is that how you get these huge structures that your mass just drops down to some level where it's you have this sort of almost massless thing?
The neutrino mass is growing, right?
It's growing. Yeah, they're growing.
So,
you have a fifth force.
So stable solutions were actually analytically, they are also
being
described.
No.
Yes, also that is independent.
That's why there's a second reference.
On that point, if there is no other question, let's thank